Well, hey everyone, welcome to this week's episode of The Vinyl Guide. This week we have an amazing guest, Mr. Jello Biafra. Jello has had an adventurous life, as most of you know, founding and fronting one of the most beloved punk bands of all time, Dead Kennedys, founding and leading the Alternative Tentacles record label, fronting bands like the Guantanamo School of Medicine and Lard, amongst others, putting out many spoken word albums, touring the world, speaking out about social issues, defending the often marginalized members of our society, and all in all, being a very creative and good-hearted human being. And while Jello has had many moments in his life that are worthy of full-length interviews, today we are interviewing Jello Biafra, the record collector. That's right, he is one of us, complete with the habits, obsessiveness, and interest, alongside the need to pick through a crate of records to find some gold. That is the Jello we're talking to today. And by the way, on this podcast, you will be hearing only about half the interview. We have the extended version of the full interview available to patrons of The Vinyl Guide at patreon.com/vinylguide. Now, if you're already a patron of the show, congratulations, go up there. You can hear the full 85-plus minute interview right now. If you're not a patron, well, it's not too late. Go to patreon.com/vinylguide. Sponsor the show, and hot damn, you'll be hearing the full conversation just like that. Plus, I'll tell the full story of this interview, what led up to it, some interesting anecdotes, all at patreon.com/vinylguide. And if you're a fan of Jello Biafra and enjoy his work and ethos, head over to alternativetentacles.com and buy a record or three. It's really fun to explore the music they have available, plus the vinyl's only like 10 or 12 bucks. So support our buddy Jello, enjoy some new music, and buy vinyl at alternativetentacles.com. And oh yeah, while you have that credit card out, big spender, go buy a Groove Washer record cleaner. They are a sponsor of this show. They have an amazing product that all record collectors need. Record cleaning kits start at less than 15 bucks. Go ask your record store for a Groove Washer, or you can get them direct at groovewasher.com. Plus, here's a 10% off promo code VINYLGUIDE10. Do it now, groovewasher.com, promo code VINYLGUIDE10. All right, without further delay, let's hear part of our interview with record collector Jello Biafra. If you want to hear more, there's another half up at patreon.com/vinylguide. Let's talk to Jello. Today on The Vinyl Guide, we are pleased to have artist, performer, record label owner and manager, and of course, fellow record collector, Mr. Jello Biafra. Now, Jello, there's a few dozen areas of your career that are quite fascinating. I'd love to get into, but today, let's start with the common ground. Let's talk about records and your record collecting hobby. Is that all right with you?
Sure.
In describing your record collection, maybe not the number of records, but how large of it, how much space does it take in your house?
Too much. You know, I have a pretty roomy place for San Francisco, but I'm starting to wonder if another 10 years I'll have a little cot in the corner of one room and then all these cubes of records from all the others. I don't know. They eat up the floor. They eat up the walls. They ate up the dining room table. That's gone now. It's not like Dr. Demento where you open up the kitchen cupboard and there's more 78 feet door. I never opened the Pandora's box 78.
They're not in the bathtub yet.
Oh, no. I have to get a bathtub.
Can you find things? Like if you were looking for a particular record, do you know roughly where things are at? Or is it frustrating just trying to identify where to even start looking for it if you're looking for a specific title?
Oh, I'm pretty good about knowing where stuff is. Not foolproof, but pretty good. I mean, I'm a librarian kid. My dad was a psychiatric social worker, and my mom ran interlibrary loan at the University of Colorado for, God, 30-plus years. So that makes me very preservation conscious, as in, you know, I still have all the cassette demos artists sent to Alternative Tentacles over the years, as well as all the the later CDRs and stuff. Mm. You know, I'd only, you know, erase a cassette that was free tape to use for myself. It was hopelessly bad. Mm. And then, but otherwise, everything is still there. And a lot, even the cassettes, about half of them are alphabetical. I had a guy do them once, and the other half arrived over the years and haven't been done since. But I have literally a hall of records upstairs. They're one side all the way going down the hall, the bedroom, and into the bedroom it's just all LPs. And then the other side is all 45s, and they're all alphabetical. And then I've run out of room, so there's like two other alphabetical sex albums now. And then there's other ones by genre of, you know, things I think are really cool that I can't kick out unless I decide I'm tired of them. Originally, in smaller piles, are the ones I was saving for mixtapes I used to make of different kinds, and I ran out of time, but the filing system stayed, and now it's too overwhelming to even think about turning them into mixtapes, let alone carve out the time. But I guess that's what DJ kids are for.
Do you separate by genre? You have, let's say, blues in one area. No, but
you know, the big alphabetical stacks. No, it's much easier to file most stuff that way. Mm-hmm. And for the most part, compilations by title. You know, and then so the 60s ones, I start forgetting the titles and I have no idea where I put those stuff. But instead of just filing everything under 60, which would be its own can of worms because there's so many of those comps.
Right.
Now, you know, and you go down to some place and I think it still exists, like Hound Dog Bop Shop in Melbourne, which is a rockabilly specialty store. And you've never seen so many rockabilly compilations and rock and roll stuff. So there's been a lot of that.
Do you do a lot of record shopping on tour? I mean, do you have like a monthly record budget that you kind of work towards and bring suitcases of stuff home when you play shows abroad?
Try to avoid getting that carried away. Mm-hmm. But can't remember if I had to mail anything back from Australia the last time or not. I did the other time, because I ran out of room in my bag. Mm-hmm. I mean, normally it's an empty DJ bag to go on my back. I can fill up with records and then, take a portable scale and make sure you can get it underweight in the bag and wrap them all up and bring home as many as you can. but there's only so much time for that on tour, because, of course, the show has to come first.
Sure.
You know, especially with the band. You know, I like to put out the kind of energy on stage, or at least try to, that I like to see in other bands. You know, put on the kind of show that I like to see. And it also means I got to prep ahead of time, you know, mill about them, stretch out, do vocal warm-ups, run for a while, then get on the stage. Then afterwards, I'm just dead and do some more of that, and then you got to get up and go to the next sound. So... Mm-hmm. There's not always a lot of time to go looking for records. The other danger being, if it is a day where I got to get all that other stuff done, there might be a 1 or 2 hour window. If it's a really good store, good luck getting me back out of it. Yeah.
Or you get stuck in traffic, or a million things could go wrong.
Yeah, exactly.
So you've been collecting records for years.
But that is. I usually come up with some pretty good stuff. Mm-hmm. And it also means I rarely go looking for records in the San Francisco Bay Area, believe it or not. There's a lot out here, but I've just come home with so much stuff. It would be nice to have time to at least listen to some of it. But I also, when I'm home, I kind of hide and work and got to get things done. And, you know, trying to properly go through Amoeba records and stuff, for example, it becomes a job.
I mean, you've been collecting records through periods when people were trying to just get rid of records. It was almost garbage, you know, one step above garbage. But now the charity shops were amazing.
That period wasn't very long.
Okay.
I mean, during the initial CD boom, a lot of older folks who didn't want to deal with it anymore dumped their records and went to CD, which meant it was the only time in my lifetime that old original Buddy Holly albums suddenly turned up and they were affordable. and a lot of other things from that period when the major labels were still figuring out the so-called teen market that they didn't even really realize existed until the late 40s, early 50s, or maybe even Elvis. So, you know, they were still trying to figure out how to market albums. And sure, they could sell Elvis albums, but they, you know, the Buddy Holly one, let alone a Bo Diddley or a Howlin' Wolf, were just kind of afterthoughts as a single. Mm-hmm. You don't see them a whole lot. But suddenly, people who had those from back in the day, they just walked in and dumped them.
With eBay and, of course, the reinterest in vinyl, Discogs, you know, those days are clearly gone. Where do you go for affordable records now?
Same place I've always gone. Secondhand shops and charity shops. Mm-hmm. I have always been a bottom feeder, and I've, you know, very quickly became pretty damn good at it. And so people are like, oh, well, man, you did an Incredibly Strange Music book, Volume 2. You ruined thrift stores because now we can't find Martin Denny anymore. I'm going, that's not my problem. Well, you know, all you have to do is go look at other things. You know, don't go looking for things you found out, Incredibly Strange Music or whatever. Just, you know, if you're going to rifle through all the really bad stuff, you can turn up a thrift store and look for something interesting or demented. You have to be willing to take chances on mysterious albums and singles. And I still score pretty good with those.
Okay. Even
maybe
in the Bay Area.
Maybe not as much as I once did, but yeah, I mean, there was one outlying place. I went to 2 thrift stores and came back with about 30 albums or so. I couldn't believe it. Hmm. Granted, a lot of it was, you know, things to put in my librarian son's library, different titles by relevant 70 people, early 80s, I just never picked up, and there they were in a nice shape. So I said, okay, I'm not going to see this cheap. I grab it now, and now I got one.
So if you find a really nice copy of a particular record, which you enjoy, and at home you have kind of a beat-up copy, you'll buy the copy that's in better shape. Do you then trade away the lesser one?
It depends. It's something super rare. I'll probably just bit on it because I don't have a lot of time to do the trades. I haven't in years. And that's kind of died on the vine to some degree. So, you know, sometimes I'll just pick up copy after copy of something like that unknown stoner rock masterpiece called Armageddon, the one where Keith Relf and the Yardbirds, lead singer, all that good stuff. And those are so cheap. And then stoner rock was coming in and all these bands were name dropping other people like Cactus as being these discoveries. And I'm like, oh my God, these people are missing out. If I find these cheap, I'll just buy them up and then give them to musicians who need to listen to them. Sometimes I'll do that. And then, you know, when I started DJing, it quickly occurred to me, you know, I don't want to wind up like what happened to my friend Alec Empire how did I space on his name? The digital hardcore labor and all that good stuff. Atari Teenage Riot, of course. And he was DJing by somewhere, and somebody just stuck and stole all his records right then and there. And I don't think he's the only one that's happened to. So some of these I began to realize, hey, wait a minute. I may have another one somewhere, and if you've been a little beat up, that can become my DJ copy. And I don't have to worry so much about awful needles or whatever, or worse yet, somebody lifting my bag and losing all this stuff. If as much as possible, I have insurance copies.
That's very clever.
Some of them, of course, I'll never find another one. Right. So damn cool. I got to play them anyway. And somebody like, oh God, what are you doing? You know, some of you give people playlists. You should be secretive about that. No, I'm not gonna be secretive. You know, the more people get interested in these records, the more likely they are to get reissued.
Do you care whether it's a reissue or a first pressing?
Oh, it depends. I mean, if the second pressing was a year later or something, it's the same standard and everything. Who cares? reissues, it's different in a lot of cases. Number one, I do like holding the real thing in my hand, especially if it's something I passed up for 10 cents as a teenager and then discovered as an adult it was really, really great. But I finally got my hands on one again. But also, that, a lot of that stuff we're talking about, I think, is pre-digital era. You know, it was done analog, or, you know, even before that, it was tubes and stuff like that. The sound is different, and it's warmer. There are ways to digitally remaster things so you get something practically that good or not better, but most people who do the reissues, even some of the mastering engineers, they either don't care, don't think people know the difference, or they have a different philosophy, like if there's no surviving tapes or there's a little bit of hiss on the tape, or, oh, we can't have this noise, nine. Oh, we must put chemotherapy through all this lost music so it sounds like there's a surgical mask over it, or worse yet, you're hearing it is clear on the other side of a wall of the next room. I mean, I've heard homemade bootlegs of lost so-called heavy psych stuff that sounds better than the so-called legitimate reissues. I mean, a major offender there would be that label called the Karma, where, you know, oh, now it's a double album. The grooves are wider. We stretched them out. What difference does that make if you sterilize the music? You know, and that's why even by the late 70s, in some places where people put high prices on things, suddenly even mono Beatles albums were valuable and desirable because they were originally recorded with the intention of being listened to in mono and not this electronically rechanneled for stereo shit, which in some cases the labels took great care to do it right, like Atlantic did pretty much across the board, or RCA's Living Stereo. But otherwise, even Columbia or Motown or whoever, you know, you've got the drums and the vocals in one speaker and everything else in the other speaker, and it sounds awful. You know, things in fat, beefy mono are very desirable, including things that came out later where you'd have a promo copy of a single, and it would be stereo, just like all the LPs on one side for the FM station. But then, just in case they could get it played on AM radio, which held on to mono way longer than they should have, but and in the long run, it killed them in the marketplace. But, you know, some of this stuff in fat, beefy mono, sure enough, that's the version of that song to have. You'll never hear it better.
Yeah.
You know, I used to have this magic cassette machine where anything I recorded on there would play back sounding as huge as a 12-inch single, a 12-inch analog single, just off a cassette. Then I had to go to the repair shop, and the repairman stepped on it. That was the end of that. But I never found another one. But that was a magic beast.
Do you find it absurd where the prices for records have gone these days? Something like Misfit singles, some of them fetching up to $1,000 each. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, anybody who'd pay $1,000 for a Misfit single deserves to be ripped off. That's all I have to say. You know, people who throw that kind of money, they're not the kind of people who are going to listen to the record. They're going to put it in plastic and then maybe frame it on the wall or pull it out for their other, you know, techie startup friends. Look what I got, you don't. And they don't go to the right home. I mean, so that's where reissues are a good thing. And when people say, oh, music is dead, oh, it died here, it died when Darby crashed, I know it died, and it's like, no, it didn't die. I mean, if you're that hard up, put down the needle, put down the bottle, get out of your apartment and go start seeing bands at random until you find some new magic somewhere. I'm all about magic accidents. I never run out of magic accidents because anything I have not personally heard, even if it was recorded before I was born, it's automatically new to me. It's fresh. And also, I think as much as some people lament large parts of the digital age, of course, the horrible impact file sharing has had on small labels like mine trying to survive, and even some of the bands trying to stay together, giving up because they can't make a go of it. Rents are so high, loans, everything else. The bohemian days are not as nice as they were in that regard. But overall, I think the digital age has been very positive for music because people say, oh, this sounds stale now. Oh, this isn't good as it used to be. It's still the best era for music we've ever been in. Why? Because it's all accessible now. You can find it on the net. You can find it on YouTube. And you can stream it, whatever, which means that people now, if they're young, they don't have a lot of money, they're really curious about cool, weird music and hungry for more, they don't have to go buying large record collections like I do. They can just get it all digitally and explore. And I think that's all for the good.
So, devil's advocate on that point. I happen to agree with you, but I think one of the things that the digital age is challenged by is the mystery of discovery and the adventure of finding a record and going out to different libraries or borrowing records from friends. I think there's a sense of community that is no longer there around music. At any moment, I can pull up one of a billion different songs. Before then, I would actually
That's the fault of the digital age or digital devices as much as how much people spend on those devices and how they relate or fail to relate to each other now. I mean, all those are tools. And, even with fake news and people who get run over by cars while crossing the street texting on their phone, and some people think, well, God, one more idiot gone. How many more to go? But, again, overall, these are tools, and they're good tools. But the question is, and we have to all ask ourselves this, because sometimes I get lost in my fucking phone and try to deflect all my emails and texts and everything else, too. And then suddenly look up and the sun's gone down. But, so I have a problem, too. But it's it's basically, are you using the tools or are the tools using you? And that's something people should be asking themselves several times a day. People find things different in different ways. And you just have to let people, use the way their own brain has been wired. So they have wired it. A friend of mine who was the lead singer in Colorado's first punk band way back when, for which I was one of the so-called roadies. Mm-hmm. 10 feet tall. All you people thought I was going to be a loser. No, I'm a roadie for the Ravers. So yeah, who then moved to New York and changed her name to the Nails and had that radio hit 88 Lines with 44 Women. Anyway, Mark Campbell, the lead singer, now has a high-end vintage stereo equipment store. Used record store in Austin, Texas, and he says there's a whole legion of younger people, late teens, early 20s, a lot of them women, who are so fed up with social media that they've gone off of Facebook and the rest, and now they're only interested in vinyl. Mm-hmm. It's a minority, to be sure. I mean, I'm grateful that the vinyl revival has rescued a lot of the great secondhand stores that were in danger of joining the, 2,000 to 3,000 of them that have gone belly up in the last several years in the United States. My favorite one, Wax Trax in Denver, it nearly died about 3 years ago, maybe four, and then vinyl began perking up again. And they say, yeah, that's what's moving for us again now. And it saves our ass. But not selling the kind of quantities that's going to make up for all the lost revenue of a small label like mine that loses file share. I mean, I get it when, you know, and that's a problem too, because when, you know, the economy never really recovered over here from the crash of 2008, and more people are being underpaid at their jobs, having a harder and harder time paying rent and other expenses, they don't have a lot of money. So the temptation to file share gets higher and higher and higher, and some people can't even, you know, they're not going to get any music because they have any control over what they're going to listen to unless they do. And so it happens. Mm-hmm. And I just wish that people who did this would, you know, pick and choose who to file share and who to actually kick down some hard-earned change to in order to keep the label and those artists going. You know, major labels go so far out of their way to rip their artists off, as do a lot of the bigger independents. Fine, file share. Fuck them. The artist's not going to see that money anyway because the executive, the shareholders, and the company at the bottom aren't going to take it all. But with a small artist and a smaller label, you know, everybody down where we are hurt. And so, you know, how about helping us out?
Have you seen an uptick in alternative tentacles business since the vinyl revival? Has that been helpful for you?
Somewhat. It has not been a savior, as I was saying. I mean, it's not going to replace all the people who stopped buying CDs and went straight to file sharing or streaming. Of course, streaming doesn't pay stick all the independents either. Mm-hmm. And but it has helped. The frustration can be that in an era when times are so goddamn tight that you know, it costs more to make vinyl than to make CDs, that vinyl is supposed to be priceless. And even though CDs have plummeted, it's not as though they're gone. I mean, my band, the Tonto School of Medicine, sells a lot of CDs at our shows. And I think the reason is a lot of people who go to those shows, a CD is a lot easier to transport home. And, you know, they don't warp in the van if you're driving around in the middle of summer. And a lot of people who wants something to hold in their hands, art to look at, get stuff straight from the band, they don't have record players. They grew up on CDs, and that's what they've got. Mm-hmm. So in the case of at least my band, yeah, we're going to keep making CDs. You know, we got advised by the distributor on the Shockify EP, oh, well, we probably should even make vinyl or CDs and just do it download only. And I'm like, fuck that. Not only does it not seem real to me, because I'm not a download guy at all, you know, I don't have time to listen to it all. I listen to what I can hold in my hand, thank you very much. You know, it's discriminating against people who like vinyl as much as I do. So, hell yeah, we made vinyl. Hell yeah, we made CDs. Did we sell thousands of them a piece, especially at our gigs? Yes, we did. Nobody who goes to a punk gig wants to buy a download card at the merch booth. It just doesn't work that way.
Right. Well, that's, and I think that was part of the point I probably ineloquently tried to make earlier, is the emotional investment in listening to something that's a download, in my mind anyway, in my feeling, I feel less invested than if I had a record in my hand, or even a cassette or a CD.
Well, that's speaking as an adult rather than a kid who's just digging the music, and the only way you can get it is off the radio, mm-hmm. which is similar in a way. You know, I mean, that, you know, obviously what led me to collecting records and wanting to have every single song I liked at my fingertips so I didn't have to wait for it to appear on the radio, as more radio, even FM, got worse and worse and worse over time. You know, I justify all my damn records as my fallout shelter from the 70s ever happened again.
So they can't take
these.
Although
away nowadays, from you. Anything you get through commercial outlets, it's even worse and even more you know, geared, it's like the early 60s after payola was used to get black artists and rock and roll off of radio, and you've got little teen idols, now known as boy bands, and, you know, just total fucking small. And we're back to that again. I mean, I'm glad there's enough curiosity and people have enough available in the digital age that they don't all grow up wanting, aspiring to want to be a winner on American Idol or, you know, or one of those kind of shows. Mm-hmm. You know, and luckily people didn't grow up like I feared, all, you know, having more of a Walter Mitty Cinderella ambition to appear in an MTV video than to perform on stage. You know, I think the on stage thing is still pretty strong. But initially all you get is the music. I mean, all I heard was the songs themselves. It was fucking magic. It immediately became what people in Alcoholics Anonymous call higher power. And that is my higher power. Mm-hmm. And the higher power isn't the records themselves. It's the music. It's the song. But in order to obtain those songs, I just got to keep getting more records. You know, every single thing I buy and bring home, especially if I'm lugging it all the way back to Australia or Argentina or whatever, every single one I buy with the intention of listening to it, not hoarding it, not selling it, not trading it. I buy my music to listen to, which I know is alien, even to some high-end record collectors and stuff. But, as vinyl and even as CDs and cassettes are a means to an end, what I'm really after, just want, you know, wanting more cool shit that just blows me the fuck away.
When you find music locally abroad, you take chances on buying records or tapes or whatever. You bring them home, you listen to them. If you don't like them, do you still keep them?
It depends. I mean, a lot of the really unbearable stuff tends to be demo CDs at this point. Mm-hmm. It's worth going through them because sometimes really great ones appear too. Or every once in a while, somebody who is completely out of their fucking skull. The most extreme example, of course, being Wesley Willis.
God bless
Wesley. Who I first heard on a cassette that a woman I knew in Chicago had made for me. Cello, I think there's somebody you need to hear. And a lot of the ones on her cassette, she'd taken off of DAT tapes. She somehow got her hands on DAT copies of stuff that Wesley never released. And he hadn't released anything yet when I first heard him. So a lot of Wesley Willis' Greatest Hits Volume 1 is Tammy Smith all the exact song sequence as she put on that compilation cassette. She really knew how to make it flow. Of course, to thank her, I had to put Wesley's song about her on Greatest Hits 1 as well.
So your collection, your taste in music comes from a lot of different directions, including albums, mm-hmm. records that were made by people who were really non-musicians, and maybe the best way to refer to them is outsider music.
I didn't hear that term till, I'm not sure Wesley Willis was even alive anymore when that came in. I mean, the first I heard that term at all was an art gallery exhibit of so-called outsider artists. Mm-hmm. It was in Chicago, and Wes was one of the artists featured. And that was where I heard the term.
Right.
I mean, there's entire museums of this stuff. In Europe, it's called Brut, Brut. And there's a Brut Museum in Paris that I haven't been to, and a Brut Museum in Lausanne in Switzerland that I have been to. Mm-hmm. All kinds of interesting things in there, and including some that clearly person making this stuff is not necessarily really differently wired mentally or somebody who was locked up all their life or whatever, but just somebody who just has a very, very strange idea of what their art should be, but otherwise, you know, is a normal or even very successful person. Mm-hmm. And I mean, one example of that would be about cider music like that would be Dr. Yahagi and the Mended Hearts. Mm. I found out about this because I was brought into little town Victoria, Texas, to do a cameo role in the movie playing the mayor of that town trying to negotiate an oil deal with a Japanese businessman played by this mustachioed Japanese national named Dr. Yahagi. And he turns out, you know, he did this on a lark, but he was a respected heart surgeon. You know, it's a big enough town, you have a heart problem, you go to this guy, period. You know, very highly regarded in this field. And he also painted, and he also makes music. And so I was able to talk him out of a copy of his CD, Dr. Yahagi and the Mended Heart. And okay, it's not Wesley Willis, but it is out there. It basically is kind of light rock and roll, but lyrically it's where it really shines. And of course, English is his second language, but he must be awfully good at it to read, you know, to master American medical science or something like that. But as far as adapting the way he learned English after growing up in Japan to writing lyrics, don't expect anything to rhyme. All of it is like, you know, all the songs are about hospital procedures and incidents. The emergency room, first we wheel the stretcher in here, then this just comes, then this one comes, and it's all like, you know, it's almost like textbooks set to music with some very odd ideas of timing, even from line to line. So I was very impressed with Dr. Yahagi and the Mended Heart.
Well, it sounds like in that case, there was a structure and some forethought put into that.
Very much so, but it's the way the forethought works that gives you a Wesley Willis or a Dr. Yahagi. And I say when it comes to music, both of them are outsider artists.
Those are also very, I guess, unique and individual efforts. When you have things like truck driver songs, like albums from all over different parts of the country that are brought together because they are from truck drivers, or singing policemen, it's a collective.
There's way more trucker tunes than anything by singing policemen.
Why do you think that?
Because you know, there aren't that many truckers who wrote trucker tunes. Mm. But all kinds of country artists, including some who specialized in it, who did, and who have. Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah, I do have a double LP compilation of all, and I think it's like done in the early 80s or something, with kind of that kind of Nashville schmaltz, unfortunately, for the era, but it's the trucking songs by truckers. Mm-hmm. And one of them also had notes that she has also posed for Playboy. And the only one I recognize as somebody who'd actually ever, you know, tried their hand at a country career was Dan McCorrison. And really the only reason I knew about him was because I saw him live when he was the lead guitar player and other singer of a local band in Boulder, who was doing kind of a country swing thing at a time when nobody was doing that, called Dusty Drapes and the Dusters. And then lo and behold, I moved to San Francisco, and then there in the Aquarius Records 50 Cent bin, Drapes from the promo pile in the 50 Cent bin, MCA signed Dan McCorrison as a solo artist. He lasted one album. You know, he had a pretty damn good voice, kind of looked a lot like Brad Paisley, too. Mm. But the only other thing I know that he did since was his one song on the Truck Songs by Truckers. So I guess that was how he paid his bill.
It seems like you not only collect the records, but you collect the stories as well.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that can be some of the best parts with the stuff that falls under outsider or incredibly strange music or just incredibly amazing backstory.
Is there a particular geography or region that seems to have a higher strike rate for outsider music?
Oh, boy. That's hard to say. I mean, you know, the bigger the city, the more likely somebody like that might find a way to come out of the woodwork, I suppose. Mm-hmm. I mean, Nicodemus is from Detroit, and Peter Grigsian was from New York City. Paul Major eventually actually found the guy and stuff. Mm-hmm. And reissued his record legitimately and everything. And Texas, there's always going to be strange stuff in Texas. I mean, Texas had the wildest 60s garage band scene outside of L.A., and it was fucking Texas. You know, this was still at a time when black people really couldn't vote there, although they're getting back to that a little too rapidly in the Trump era. But, you know, and L.A., of course, was an industry town, and you could get places, and there were deep studios, and people wanted to put out records, and people willing to get totally wild with it.
Right.
But
a lot more people in LA seem to have those sort of dreams.
A lot more really wild garage stuff classics out of LA than say New York or Chicago, or you know, a lot of stuff in Michigan too, not just Detroit.
Mm. Okay.
But Texas and LA, this is the bottomless pit of this stuff. And outsider, just you never know. I mean, you just never know.
So when you go to a record store, you're not really looking on the walls or new arrivals. It sounds like you probably gravitate more toward the bargain bins to try to find some of these hidden gems, yeah?
Well, the first thing you walk into, you always check the wall. You never know what's up there. Hmm. And then give you a clue as to what the store is about, too. And then if it's a used store, new arrivals is a good place to start because it's the new arrival, you know, and it hasn't been picked yet, relatively. And so I those are generally the first spots and things. And then, you know, often if I'm going to go through the stacks and it looks like it could be interesting, I go for the 45s quicker than the LPs. Because there's more likely to be magic accidents in there that nobody spotted.
Right. Okay.
Especially if you can listen to them at the store. It was a year or two before that store that was near my high school I got all that stuff out of ever got a record player in there. So once they did, I slowly but surely went through every other record in the store just to find out what it all was. Have a little map in my mind. Okay, this is $2 now. If it goes down to a buck, I'll get it. Or if it goes down to 50 cents, I'll get it. No, I'm not going to buy this unless it's free, blah, blah, blah.
What's the most you've ever paid for a record?
$300. Mm-hmm. I only did that once.
Yeah. Which record was it?
It was for that, you know, you may have even heard of these guys, those South American psychedelic legends from Peru called Traffic Sound. Whose music is so good that had they come out of America or Europe, they'd be playing stadium. Still, they just really, really were just a fantastic band. And the one most people go after is Virgin, which is a great album that just sounds like you're floating on top of the Andes, whether you smoked any weed or not. You know, they just really had something special going on. But then there's an earlier one. Just called, I think it's Bailar Gogo, to dance, the go-go. And there's a picture of a bunch of boats on the cover of all things. Mm-hmm. Just a generic stock thing. And that's the really heavy, you know, the heavy side of heavy sight. And the only copy I'd ever seen on anybody's list, back when there were, you know, the printed list stuff, was a beat-up copy for $3,000. Oof. And so when somebody else's list had a, you know, allegedly near mint one for $300, I jumped on it and I got it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, of course it's a little crackly, Peru being pressing, but what great music. Hmm. Although then the joke was on me, was because 2 or 3 months later, all those albums got reissued in the United States.
Of course.
But yeah. I still play my Peruvian copy. Thank you very much. But you know, that's an absolute magical band.
It sounds like your collection is quite huge, thousands, tens of thousands of records, perhaps. What sort of plans have you made for after you pass on? Is there anything that's going to happen to those records?
Not sure. I got to get that organized. I think the best thing to do would be to set up a trust, you know, with like something like five to nine members, so there could be no tie votes, so people decide what to do with alternative tentacles, what to do with the album, the house, everything else. But I haven't drawn that up. Probably ought to do that one of these days. I mean, part of the problem is I haven't been able to find any probate lawyer who takes me seriously on the other part of my will. You know, I want my flesh ground up and made into sausages and then sold on eBay with the money given to PETA. And then the embalmed part can just hang medieval style in a metal cage from a traffic signal in downtown San Francisco to drip on all the yuppies and everything. And then after that, I want an open casket ceremony, but I want somebody like Survival Research Labs or GWAR to put some metal rods inside that they can remote control. So then I sit up in the coffin and climb out and start chasing people.
Are any of these points negotiable?
And after that, of course not. And after that, there's a really old graveyard right in the middle of the neighborhood where I grew up in Boulder, Colorado, Pioneer Cemetery. Tom Horan, the Wild West Outlaw, is buried there. But no one has been buried there in many, many years, but that doesn't mean that I shouldn't be. Why? Because somewhere in the early part of the 20th century, nobody seems to know now whether it was a car or a wagon that ran over a child and killed them. So the gravestone for the child was meant to look like a lollipop. And it has a red and black, it did have red and black paint on it, but it looked kind of like the Target video logo. But it was this big lollipop. And I thought, you know, isn't it about time Boulder and Pioneer Cemetery got another lollipop? Only mine would be an eyeball, the exact same size as the Target video lollipop, and it would move and follow you as you walk by. I think that would be awesome. I'd almost have to fake my own death just to see it fill.
Oh, God, you bring me such great joy, Jello. I'm so glad you exist.
Sometimes I am, too, but I got to deal with the whole package.
Jello, I do want to thank you for joining us here on the show. I do want to direct people, if they're interested in Alternative Tentacles music, go to alternativetentacles.com, Jello's label. Of course, there's plenty of bands to check out there. Also go to
a variety of different genres too. I mean, kind of, you know, sometimes maybe it's not Achilles heel, but there's no alternative tentacle sound like there is a Fat Record sound, an Epitaph sound, an Amphetamine Reptile sound, whatever. You know, we're very eclectic, and there is a core that buys everything we put out because of that. We can't sustain ourselves on that alone, but I just, you know, I can't stop doing this.
Well, yeah, look, I've been listening to the records from the label for well over 20 years now. There's always interesting stuff up there. So go up there, experiment, listen to a few things, grab a few things. You could also go to follow Jello on Facebook, facebook.com/JBiafra. And you can see what he's up to.
I hope that's a real one, because I avoid Facebook like the plague.
It looks like the real one. Well, there's about 250,000
people. The Alternative Tentacles office did set up a Jello Biafra Facebook page to try and get rid of all the fake Jello Biafra Facebook pages, which it largely did, but hasn't completely accomplished that. And, you know, sometimes I'll send things down to the label, post on social media, or show people this, and they probably put it up there, among other things. So a lot of that, you know, weird pictures or sometimes weird news articles and shit, that probably did come from me. But as far as other communique goes, since after my band in Tom of School of Medicine got going, I didn't really have time to, you know, put together the full spoken word shows anymore. So, you know, for spoken word, I have that series of YouTube rants called What Would Jell-O Do?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, those are up on the page.
Yeah, I found an old What Would Jesus Do shirt at a thrift store, so I just got out a piece of masking tape and put my own name across it, and off I went. It's yet another YouTube project.
Have you legally changed your name to Jell-O Biafra?
No.
No, okay.
It's a good, I realize what a good thing it is, but I haven't. Every time I get pulled over by the cops, and every time I'm going through customs.
You're absolutely right. Those are places you don't want to stick out.
Yeah. All right.
All right, Jell-O, thank you so much for spending time with us. I really do appreciate it, man.
Thank you.
All right. Oh, man, that was awesome. I got to speak to one of my heroes. I can't believe it. Jell-O Biafra on the Vinyl Guide. And by the way, what you just heard was about half the episode. Head over to patreon.com/vinylguide, sponsor the Vinyl Guide podcast, and you'll get the whole episode up there, plus a whole bunch of stuff too. So that's patreon.com/vinylguide, the full 85-plus minute Jell-O Biafra interview up there now. And that's it for this week's episode of The Vinyl Guide. Thanks again for tuning in. Please feel free to share this episode with your friends, share it on social media, on Facebook, tweet about it, put it on Instagram. By the way, you can follow us on various social media platforms, facebook.com/vinylguide, instagram.com/vinylguide, and on Twitter @TheVinylGuide. So we'll be back soon with a brand new episode. So until we talk next time, keep spinning. Cheers.
That's it for this episode of The Vinyl Guide. Send your thoughts to Nate@thevinylguide.com or follow or tag us on Instagram @VinylGuide. Until next time, keep spinning.